And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
It's as ancient as time itself, the annual migration of the baby salmon to the sea, and then the return up the great rivers, braving the rushing waters to the very spot where they were born. For thousands of years, the people of the Columbia River tied their lives to the lives of the salmon. We go in depth as we follow this story through the twists and turns that put the salmon central to today's show. It's all coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
This week, the annual salmon season was opened on the Klamath River, and things don't look good. Few of the sport fishermen are coming home with a catch. There was a time in the not-so-distant future, the rivers ran thick with salmon. Not any longer. Like so many other things, the salmon are on the edge. Today, we take a long journey into the world of salmon, as we head up the Columbia River, where salmon have been central to all peoples who live there for as long as can be remembered. This is a special edition of the Wild Side News, and we begin the story following the news. So first, the news. With the fear of higher taxes and government regulation inspiring his comments, ex-Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich said conservatives should push a new science and technology-based, entrepreneurial, market-oriented, and locally-led environmentalism rather than a remedy that relies heavily on government regulation and litigation. His comments came in a debate with Senator and ex-presidential hopeful John Kerry, sponsored by New York University, the Brookings Institution, and the Cato Institute. Kerry countered that we had lived for 15 years on a voluntary framework to address issues of climate change, and they had not worked. The two agreed that they were essentially more in agreement than disagreement, and that these two icons of political pull could come up with legislation to address global warming that would be acceptable to both conservatives and progressives. A three-judge panel of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco upheld a ruling by District Court Judge James Redden, which rejected the Bush administration's plans to help Columbia Basin hydroelectric dams become more helpful to salmon survival. The plan included adding more removable fish spillways, but most controversial was an administration interpretation, which concluded that the dams be considered a natural part of the ecosystem as they were in place when the Endangered Species Act was enacted. The Redden decision requires the dams to increase the release of greater amounts of water to allow young salmon a higher probability of successfully making their way back to the ocean. This would result in a lower overall electric power output by the hydroelectric dams. The Redden decision also held open the possibility that four lower Snake River dams be breached to restore access by salmon to their ancestral breeding grounds. We'll be covering this issue in depth during today's show. A report released by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, concludes that if the world's temperatures increase by 2 to 4 degrees, fully 20 to 30% of the world's species of plants and animals are placed at risk of becoming extinct. In addition, the report predicts more droughts, floods, forest fires, and heat waves. Water shortages are also predicted due to reduced snowpack and earlier spring runoffs, decreasing available water to communities which rely on water stored throughout the summer and released, as it is now, throughout the summer months. Al Gore continues his forays into mass media marketing of awareness of the climate crisis to the entire world, as Live Earth concerts have been announced in venues around the world to be held July 7th of this year. The new campaign, called Save Ourselves, The Campaign for a Climate in Crisis, will feature some of the world's leading musicians, anticipated to reach over 2 billion people around the world. The concerts will be broadcast on NBC and over 120 networks around the world and streamed live on the Internet. Proceeds from the concerts will help fund a foundation led by the Alliance for Climate Protection, chaired by former Vice President Al Gore. The lineup is stellar, including Madonna, the Beastie Boys, the Black Eyed Peas and Red Hot Chili Peppers, the Foo Fighters and others who are performing in the concert in London. The U.S. concert, held the same day, will be held in Giant Stadium in East Rutherford, New Jersey, and features Bon Jovi, Dave Matthews Band, John Mayer, Smashing Pumpkins. Well, you get the picture. Other venues include Shanghai, China, Johannesburg, South Africa, Sydney, Australia, Tokyo, and Rio de Janeiro. If anyone has a spare ticket, please contact the host. And that's the news. And a few announcements. The Wildside News is happy to announce that starting May 3rd, you will be able to hear from 10 of the world's leading environmental spokespeople as we launch the weekly Earth Summit. Be sure to tune in each week for the most important 10 minutes on Earth. And remember that Earth Day is not far off. It's time to make your Earth Day resolutions for a better world. And now we go in depth as we track the story of the salmon. Every day we're inundated with more and more stories about what's happening to the Earth. We hear about the challenges of global warming and climate change. We hear about the fact that the oceans are in decline and many, many, many other stories. And the kind of the unfortunate truth is the fact that these stories just keep coming in. And one of those that I feel has a very significant real impact to tell us the fact that things are changing and they're becoming more complex and that we have enormous challenges ahead of us to try to turn around the impact that humans have had. We've done our best. We've tried to make a better world, but in that process, unfortunately, we have made some missteps and some mistakes. One of the stories that's happening is coming from the west coast of the United States, and it has to do with salmon. We've all heard the stories of the salmon, the great salmon migrations up the rivers, and it's really truly a romantic saga and a story of power and mystery. But that story has a new dimension, and that is the fact that the salmon runs are dramatically diminishing along the western coast. There's been a court ruling recently that in efforts to try to change some of the policies that have been affecting the revival of salmon. And now joining us from Portland, Oregon is Charles Hudson, who is the public affairs manager with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. Charles, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you, Sydney. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Yes. Now, you yourself have been very much involved in this issue of salmon and fish and rivers and Native American issues and rights. Give us a little personal history on how you came to this.
Well, I'm a member of the Hidatsa tribe from North Dakota, from the Fort Berthold Reservation in western North Dakota on the Missouri River. My family, going back many generations, were holy people. My great-grandfather was a Chief Old Dog, was a chief. My grandfather, Martin Cross, was a chairman for our tribe during a very, very tumultuous and painful era during the 40s and 50s when throughout this country, throughout the United States, great tragedies were befalling Indian people in terms of termination of Indian tribes and modern era seizure of lands, building of dams that dislocated huge numbers of people from their ancestral homes. That was the case with my family. My grandfather fought very hard to prevent the Garrison Dam from being built on the Missouri River, and ultimately he lost that fight. And in some ways, it cost him his life. He died of a broken heart a few years after the dam was built. My parents were relocated, along with many, many people, from the Missouri bottomlands to mainly agricultural towns in western North Dakota that were not very receptive to these new Indian people. and ultimately they moved on, like many Indian people in the western United States, relocated in the 50s and 60s to major West Coast cities, Midwest cities, and tried to forge a new life. That was where, you know, my life began in Oakland, California, but it also marked a beginning of a new era of Renaissance and Indian activism that led to many of some of the most progressive policies in American Indian history. The Indian Self-Determination Act in the mid-70s really turned the tide, and capacity building among tribes began, and tribal people began to graduate from high school and then go to college and become lawyers and doctors. And that is where the story, my tribal story, personal story, picked up of my uncle fighting in court for, really picked up the battle that his father lost. My uncle, Raymond Cross, ultimately won on behalf of our people a considerable judgment for illegal taking of land in the Missouri by these mammoth federal projects. I now work in the for four Indian tribes on the Columbia River who have a similar history of massive hydroelectric projects put forth by the Corps of Engineers and Bureau of Reclamation, built for reasons that were defined way back when in the New Deal era. The FDR administration caused great upheaval with these tribes, dislocation of people, flooding of sacred lands, of their sacred fishing areas, of burial grounds, and really a wholesale disruption of their economy, their spirituality, their place on earth. This organization I work for works very hard to restore, to reclaim some of what was lost, restore some of the ecological integrity, and in so doing, restore some of the spiritual health and well-being of the people.
It's an amazing story, and part of the story of your family has been turned into a book. Is that something you wish to share?
Yes, I tend to relate it this way, that there are stages in any great loss suffered by an individual or family or a people. There are identifiable stages of loss. There's the shock, there's the denial, there's the grief, and ultimately the healing. And that sequence certainly has played out among Indian people. Many of us who were born after the shock and the denial came into the picture during the grief and then ultimately the healing. And while we all felt this, it was very hard to tell the story ourselves. We told it and talked about it amongst each other, but it was very hard to ponder a comprehensive telling of that experience. And a writer who befriended our family, a very good writer named Paul Van de Velder, was seeking to write written many great essays and short stories for many national publications, and was ready to write his first novel and had a few ideas. And his publicist said, the story of the Cross family and the Missouri River is your story. It is the story. And that set him on a path of spending several years with our family, gathering oral histories and personal anecdotal elements to what eventually became a book called Coyote Warrior, which came out in 2005. By those who have read it, a very life-changing read about the history of not just our family, but a story that relates to the Western Hemisphere's experience and draws on the policies of the Vatican back in the 14th and 15th century. All of those elements have been brought to bear in this hemisphere on two indigenous people. Many of the federal policies relate directly to some of the directives and papal bulls back in several generations prior. So Mr. Van de Velder goes through much of that history, sets up the issue by a thorough telling of the tale going back over 500 years, and brings us into the modern here and now. And in the end, it's a very uplifting story because at its heart, Indian country is resilient. We're a culture that refuses to say die. And not unlike the fish, the salmon in the western United States. As long as they keep fighting upriver, we'll keep fighting with them.
I've been very fortunate to spend time in the desert Southwest and therefore have a real sensitivity to Native American cultures and have had the opportunity to pick up books on occasion and delve into some of these histories, and one becomes transformed to another world. The stories as told, for example, in Coyote Warrior, bring one to a whole different perspective, and those journeys into another world, I think, are important for us right now as we try to figure out what in the world we're supposed to do with our world in crisis. There's a lot to be learned. I would have to imagine that the story that you've lived through, I wish to know more about this process of providing real truth, providing real insight into the relationship of humans and their earth and their world and nature, trying to impart that out to the world and having it literally ignored and decimated and totally disrespected. And now we find that those truths are coming back now full scale. You were right on. I'd like to, in that sense, then talk about move up the upriver from the ocean, from the Pacific, up into the Columbia River, because that's where your current this current issue is really being defined. Talk to us now about what your work and along the Columbia and the history of the salmon to these. It's a whole diversity of Native peoples that fill that watershed. Try to give us a sense of that.
The story of salmon and salmon people, or what we call Wiconishpum, that is a Sahaptan Indian word for salmon. Wiconish means salmon, and Pum means people. We often use the blended term Wiconishpum to identify the salmon people of the Columbia River. It's an epic story in so many ways, from the life cycle of the salmon, which is a miracle unto itself, this reasonably small fish that shows such resilience in traveling so many thousands and thousands of miles in its life and evades any number of obstacles and dangers. Many perish along the way, both natural and man-made, but they have this instinct somewhere, somehow, some creator-provided instinct that draws them right back to the precise place of their birth and to simply start the cycle all over again. It's an amazing story. You could just talk about salmon, and Indian people do, and can talk for hours about the salmon, the creation stories of the Sahaptan people in the Columbia. Among them are the name salmon people is not a fabrication. At one time, salmon and people were the same being. When the Creator asked two people to step forward and jump into the river and go down and to go out and search the world to bring back necessary elements gathered in the ocean and bring them back to the people who sacrificed themselves by jumping in. And that is one of the creation stories of the Sahaptan people, that at one time salmon and the people were brothers and sisters. And in fact, during traditional feasts, it is acknowledged that the salmon are the brothers, the elk and deer are other brothers, the roots and the berries are the sister foods, and they are harvested, prepared, and served as such. Men hunt for the elk and the game. They fish for the salmon. The women gather, dig the roots and gather the berries. At ceremonial feasts, they're prepared likewise by the brothers and sisters, and then served to the attendees as brothers and sisters. There's little segregation of the spiritual self with the rest of the world. That is the way we approach our work here at the Intertribal Fish Commission in our efforts to restore fish, is that let's not segregate these things. It's not simply an economic discussion as opposed to a biological one. We must blend them to actually get results. We must consider all things. We must consider the life cycle of the fish and the human experience in that combined holistic manner.
And we're going to talk about where things are headed in the future as the interview progresses here, our discussion. But I do have this question, because I think it's very important. Within the traditions, the oral traditions and others, for how many years, how many hundreds and or thousands of years do the people of the Columbia River Basin trace their lineage with the salmon?
Well, there's a phrase that Indian people use in the Columbia River, and its English translation is "since time immemorial." And in the view of the tribal people, there is no point when the calendar started. It has always been this way, that the Creator gave life. The Creator created the relationship by virtue of his request to the Indian people to become as well salmon people, and it has been that way. There's no date that can be applied to it.
Part of the pain that I suffer as I cover so many of these stories and is the fact that in so many of these stories, these traditions have been extant for literally thousands of years, or that the habitats that were the forests, the prairies, have been in existence for literally millions of years, being and going through the cycles of life. And the same is true in the story of the Columbia River people, that for is it fair for me to say thousands of years in a more scientific realm?
It would be fair to say in excess of 10,000 years.
Okay. That these traditions, and this is, I think it's important for us to really get a sense of this, these traditions go back and have been holistically maintained for literally thousands of years. And then suddenly things began to change dramatically and have totally disrupted what has been otherwise a self-sustaining system for thousands of years. Tell us when these changes really began to be felt within the communities on the Columbia.
Elders will tell you that there has always been change. There have always been modifications and trade and intermarriage among Native people and modifications to some methods. But by and large, the relationship between Indian people and their natural world has been mindful of one another. In the Columbia Basin, the Columbia River people lived under what is called Tamenwit, and loosely translated, that means the law. And a more expanded translation is all the knowledge we need to know of ourselves, of each other, and our world. In the longhouse, there's a ceremony in which a song, a verse is repeated over and over again, and the hand alternately points to the heart, to the heavens, and to the ground, emphasizing the link between the three. For thousands and thousands of years, this law, Tamenwit, guided our conduct on the earth with the fish, with the deer, with the roots and the berries, that, again, we weren't superior beings. We were partners. We were equals with all beings on the earth. That whole worldview was disrupted in a huge way with the coming of the European settlers and that wave of settlers and their view of religion, their view of economics, their view of trade, some of the disease brought from that continent abruptly and radically changed that relationship, that law, and in most cases put that worldview in direct conflict with what came from Europe. More specifically, in the early 1800s, the pursuit of gold in the West, the pursuit of farmland in the 1840s changed the Columbia Basin, where tribal people had resided in tributaries of the Columbia River and migrated from ridgetop to river bottom with the seasons, gathering game, gathering berries and roots as they ripened, and then down the river to the Great Falls of Celilo to fish when the spring Chinook were running, and gathering eels, the lamprey at other rocky falls and tributaries. It was a system of abundance that allowed the people of the Columbia Basin to be among the most healthy people in the world, that the food supplies were abundant. It provided ample time for trade, for an expanded artistic and philosophical world to be to flourish in the form of art and trade with other parts of Western North America.
Were they associated with the potlatch ceremonies of the coastal?
The potlatch ceremonies were primarily north along the coast, mm-hmm. Going up into British Columbia. Mm-hmm. There was a shared sense of sharing, of a shared resource. and much of the river and resources were managed in a very collaborative way. There would, for instance, at Celilo, there was a council of chiefs that would gather and make decisions about when fishing would occur, when fishing would stop, and this was all based on the knowledge that there were other people much farther upriver that needed salmon to come up and reach them, as well as salmon that needed to reach their spawning grounds. So it was a very collaboratively understood resource and collaboratively managed resource. The depletion of salmon began in the latter part of the 1800s, when the United States was reasonably well established. Most of the states in the lower 48 had achieved statehood, and many of the treaties had already been signed, as in the case of our tribes. The forefathers of modern tribal people here negotiated treaties in 1855 with the United States government. They were treaties of peace, and I think it is the view of our tribal people that those tribal leaders who negotiated the aspects of those treaties were truly visionary. They truly understood the world around them. They understood the greed of the white man. They understood what they saw as a tainted view of the earth that they brought. And so in their negotiations of the treaties, they reserved the right. While they ceded or relinquished much, much land and much, much wealth, they reserved certain aspects of their world that they viewed as essential to their continued existence. And chiefly among them was the salmon and the right to forever harvest the salmon.
That is truly visionary at that point in history.
By the late 1800s, Americans discovered this fish, and they saw it immediately as a cash crop and harvested it as such in the lower Columbia River. Massive cannery operations began harvesting massive amounts of fish. They weren't viewed as fish per se, but purely as poundage, and they were hauled out of the river in huge nets and processed, canned, and then shipped throughout the United States. Back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, salmon became a staple of the American diet, not unlike tuna. Tuna has been for the last 30, 40 years. That very aggressive harvest of the species was followed shortly thereafter by another idea, and that was that, in the view of the tribes, a very tainted idea, and that was that a free-flowing river was a wasted river. Suddenly, it occurred to the non-Indian that the Columbia River could be harnessed for other uses. The fisheries resource was beginning to be depleted by overfishing and growth in the West. There were war efforts that were looming, the need to electrify the more rural areas of the country was there, and a proposal to massively industrialize rivers began in the Columbia began in the early 1930s through the Bonneville Power Act.
In just a moment, we return with part two of the story of the salmon when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
For thousands of years, the salmon has been an integral part of our world. But as with so much of the living world, the past 200 years have changed the very nature of life itself. Struggling now for its survival with the help of an increasing number of dedicated individuals, the common sense of communion is beginning to make a difference. We continue our journey when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Our in-depth journey of the Chinook continues with Charles Hudson.
The first massive dam on the Columbia was Grand Coulee, which to this day is one of the largest dams in the world. It cut off the migration of fish up into Canada. That was followed by dam after dam after dam on the Columbia and Snake Rivers and many tributaries, to the point now where only about a third of what had once been productive salmon habitat remains. Roughly two-thirds of salmon habitat that existed in the Columbia Basin, a region about the size of France, about a third remains viable for salmon survival.
And I'm just curious then, it is a six-state area that is served by the Columbia. The tributary draws from at least that region as well as Canada.
Yeah, yeah. The Columbia Basin includes parts of actually seven states and two Canadian provinces. It is the most lucrative hydropower-producing river in the world. It provides some navigation. There's no question that some dams can provide multiple societal benefits, and I think some tribal people will be among the first to tell you that some dams can provide benefits. But in that orgy era of dam building in the 40s, 50s, 60s, right up into the mid-70s, there were many dams that were built that were poorly conceived. We are dealing with those today in a big way as salmon populations are now declining, have been declining rapidly since the last of these dams went in. Many of them were built for very narrow-minded purposes. In the case of the Snake River dams, there were four large projects put in simply to get a few barges up and down the Snake River and turn a small Idaho town into functionally a seaport some 600 miles from the ocean. Those dams are lethal to salmon in the Snake River, one of the most promising and previously productive salmon producing rivers in the world.
One typically doesn't think of native reliance on salmon that far inland because it's lost from our memory. And I have to wonder what happened to those cultures as dams went in and suddenly that salmon was eliminated because the dam was there. What are there stories that you can share?
Well, the effects, and again, this is a story of national, where there are national similarities where people have been dislocated, their primary food supply cut off. A lesser known element of the loss of salmon was the reality that what had happened to the Plains Indians cut off the buffalo, kill the buffalo, cut off the food supply, and you can subjugate the Indians, and that horrible dynamic played itself out in the Columbia River in the 20th century. The thing about salmon, we have lost in this world countless species, countless flora, countless fauna. The thing about salmon, and the one that makes it such a politically hot issue and such a tumultuous geopolitical issue, is that salmon have a very strong commercial value. They've always had a great value to native people, but they continue to have very strong commercial value to the non-Indians as well. It has pitted access to salmon culture against culture. And in the 40s and 50s, one of the stakeholders that was happy to see dams go in were commercial fishermen in other parts of the Columbia River, because if the feeling was build a dam, you will cut off tribal access to their fishing grounds. So the tribal people were up against a real tough suite of adversaries in the fight to keep the Columbia River and the tributaries ecologically secure. The loss of fish is pretty well documented. Historically, back in the days pre-Lewis and Clark, approximately 16 million fish every year entered the mouth of the Columbia and spawned in any number of tributaries. Over the past 20 years, the average has been about 1.5 million fish. They are just a remnant of what they once were. In the farther you get up the river, the more the problem compounds. And it's an absolute truth that each dam compounds the problem. When you get farther the river, fish are expected to survive the effects of 8 and even 9 dams. It's a very tough challenge. On their best day, they have a 1% chance of actually completing their life cycle.
In terms of the upriver dams, how many of them have fish ladders?
Most of the lower dams have fish ladders. As fish move up the Columbia River, after 9 dams, the 10th dam they encounter is called Chief Joseph Dam. Ironically, one of the great salmon chiefs in the Columbia Basin, the great chief, as first chief, Chief Joseph, there is a dam named after him, and it has no fish ladder. That is up in north central Washington. As a fish would move up the Snake River, it encounters 8 dams before it runs into what's called Hell's Canyon Dam in Hell's Canyon on the Snake, and that has no fish ladder. So that is functionally the end of the line for fish. Areas above those dams were once very productive for sockeye, summer Chinook, fall Chinook. Now fish simply cannot get there and are left to we're left to protect the available spawning area below. You had earlier asked about the impacts of the loss of fish. Quite frankly, many of those impacts are still being identified. There was no doubt that there has been great cultural effects of the loss of fish, and not just the loss of fish from the diet, but the loss of fishing opportunity as a means of perpetuating culture. It's a known fact that the act of fishing was one of the most elemental relations between fathers and sons, wives, brothers, grandfathers, grandmothers in the Columbia Basin. In the act of fishing, it was a communal family activity. Everybody had a particular job to do. There was an understanding that each person needed to play a role in the act of going to the fishing site, fishing, the encampment, the preparing of fish, the appropriate spiritual preparation, the once the fish were harvested, the blessing of the fish, the actual processing, gutting, drying, smoking, curing of the fish, and preparing it for the home, preparing it for for trade, preparing it for spiritual ceremonies. It took everybody in the family and the clan to participate in the act of fishing. Once fish went away and the opportunity to fish went away, all of that broke down. And families on the Missouri River and the Columbia and Snake River fell into disarray. All of the basic building blocks of their family structure, their communal structure, evaporated as the fish vanished. On top of that, the absence of fish from the table, the number one staple in the diet in the Columbia, was fish for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. When that food left the picture, left the table, it had to be replaced by something. And sadly, it was often replaced by federal food programs, very high fat, high starch, high sugar, high salt alternatives. That is still playing out in Indian country. The detrimental health effects of losing traditional foods has resulted in elevated diabetes, obesity, heart disease, incidence of cancer, etc. The full weight of the loss of the traditional diet is still being revealed
You made such an interesting point. It's subtle and yet fundamental. You said that the process of hunting itself, now we're going to go back to literally the catching of the fish, was a strong bonding element between fathers and sons, but as well, I'm sure, it had a lot to do with literal physical stamina, mental ability, mental acuity, et cetera, which is the central point of life itself. Discuss some of the traditional ways in which fish were literally taken.
Fish were harvested in any number of ways. Most commonly, tribal people gathered at waterfalls, large waterfalls, small waterfalls. That was a place where fish would be forced to wait, to pause, to gather their strength to move up the waterfall farther upriver. A typical tribal fishing site is what is called a scaffold, and that is a wooden platform, or sometimes it's simply just a place on a rocky outcropping at a waterfall where a long dip net, or what's called a dip net or hoop net, or even a gaff hook could be reached down into the water, and fish would either swim into them, or in the case of a gaff hook, a fisherman would lower it, and fish, keep in mind, were so plentiful that if you dipped your gaff hook into the water, though you couldn't see because of the turbulence of the water at a waterfall, you could feel fish bumping up against it. And a fisherman would simply put the gaff hook down, wait for that bump, and pull up and hook a fish. But the most typical method was with the what's called a dip net, and that would be a small hoop with a net on the end of a long pole. And that net would be lowered into the river, very long, you know, 20, 30 foot long pole, and then just moved slowly because it requires great upper body strength and balance to move it into very strong current. And then when you feel the weight and the tug, you would know that there would be a fish, and then it would be pulled up quickly to your perch.
And that is my point, and thank you. It maintained literal physical strength and acumen to be able to do that, which then was spread throughout the tribe, I have to believe, you know.
And it also, I don't want the point of it being a communal activity to be lost here, because at a waterfall, there's not room for 10,000 people all at one time. There may be 40, 50, 100 good fishing positions available at a site like that, and it was very much shared. There are wonderful stories about the inherent and built-in limits of families, that how they shared a resource and how they never used more than they absolutely needed, and that families would construct, for instance, a box of a particular size that represented the family's fish needs for the year. And when that box got full, then they were done. They weren't looking for the biggest fish, the best-looking fish. They were simply looking for the right number of fish that would sustain them over the course of the year. The term sustainability is obviously enjoys great modern use. It was sustainability in a practiced way.
Well, and that's where we started out, and that is that many of the truths that you were talking about it in the early stages of this, we're becoming aware of them ourselves, this relationship of ourselves to nature itself. Well, amazingly enough, the story continues, and the Bonneville Dam was built ultimately in, I think, the 1930s, and as well other dams up the river, but as well these treaties that existed that maintained the rights of Columbia River Native Americans to fish along the rivers was maintained. Give us a sense of how that developed through those years, and then this will kind of help us to understand what's going on now.
Well, after the dams were built, the region was plunged into some very dark, a dark period around, I would call it societal change. There were, Americans will know, the war years ensued in the late 30s through the 40s, and followed by the Korean War. Dynamics of war, of growth, all have been brought to bear on the Columbia River, on the river itself, on the salmon resource. The need for power, the absolute greed, quite frankly, to get the cheapest power available has plagued the Columbia River and the effort to keep fish and salmon viable, to keep water quality as pure as it can be. The tribal people often tell the story that when they fished on their fishing platforms, there would be, as well as a dip net on a net at the end of a pole, there would be a small can or gourd on another pole that could be dipped into the Columbia River and water and drank directly right out of the Columbia. There's not a tribal person living today that would dare drink the water out of the Columbia River. It has become too contaminated, and that's another fight that is being fought by the tribes, is to restore the Columbia River to a drinkable form. And that is one that's playing out in many, many watersheds around our world, is the desire to bring water quality back to the form it once was, and that is, in its simplest way, drinkable. The era of dam building, great development. Cities have grown. The population of the Pacific Northwest has grown. One of the stories we don't talk about as much, but it is certainly a major factor in the decline of fish, is the enormous degradation of habitat, of deforestation, of the conversion of natural landscapes into agricultural zones. All of these have caused water quality in particular to degrade, that is, to add more sediment into the rivers, and compounded by dams. A free-flowing river has a natural ability to cleanse itself to some extent. A dammed river does not. Sediment toxins that enter the river simply enter a pool as opposed to a free-flowing river and settle down into the sediment base of the river. As well, the spawning areas, fish need clean, clear water. They need gravel. They need clean gravel to carve out a nest, lay their eggs, and then cover those nests up with gravel again. When you deforest an area in a watershed, each rain brings silt sediment into the river, and the gravel, the clean gravel, is more and more scarce in the Columbia River. This is a story that is being repeated in many, many river systems and watersheds throughout the Pacific Rim, and as well now in Asia, in the Kamchatka and Sakhalin Island, places we know that are great producers of salmon, Alaska. Deforestation, this similar erosion of habitat, deforestation has degraded river quality, spawning ground viability, and certainly has happened in Oregon and Washington and Idaho and in Canada. That's another fight. So the problems are incremental. The problems are compounding. It would be unfair to say it's all the dam's problem. It is a complex suite of things that have hurt the fish. The water temperatures, because of deforestation, the loss of what is called riparian buffers, that is the rich growth of trees and willows alongside small streams and tributaries. When that's taken away, water is exposed immediately to the sun, to solar rays, and it begins getting warmed up at the highest elevations. When you do that, when you compound that problem, now water in the Columbia Basin is as much as 20 degrees higher than it was in its pristine state. Salmon can thrive in water up to about 68 degrees Fahrenheit. There are many, many, many days now in the year when water temperature in the Columbia Basin exceeds 68 degrees and is high at times as the high 70s, and even gets into the low 80 degrees in some places in the lower river. That is, while it may not be immediately lethal, every day, every minute a fish spends in water higher than 68 degrees, its life essentially is at risk. Even if it survives to get to the spawning grounds, its biology, its physiology may be so affected that it may not be able to actually complete its life cycle and spawn before it dies.
For many, many, many reasons, you are working in a broad context to do something to turn this enormous story around and to minimally restore and maintain the native people's rights and capacity to catch fish, but that's diminishing every year. The salmon season is being diminished all along the West Coast because of the lack of salmon. What can you tell us about the status of salmon in the last, let's say, 5 or 10 years? What's happening to their populations?
Well, there's good news and bad news out there about salmon restoration. Some of the good news is salmon are the most studied species on the face of the earth. There have been countless millions of dollars spent studying salmon, some for legitimate reasons, some for not so legitimate reasons. We know an awful lot about the life cycle of salmon. We know what they need. We know what hurts them. There are fewer and fewer secrets about what fish need to effectively restore them. There are some new wrinkles, of course, and some very big wrinkles, like the effects of climate change, the effects climate change will have on snowfall and rainfall in these large river systems. We know that we've got new challenges associated with salmon management due to climate change. We also know that there are many mysteries and always changing circumstances in the oceans, and those are things we have very little control over. We can't force the ocean to adjust to any really man-made need. We simply have to adapt to what the ocean provides us. The other bit of good news is that there remains a strong core of both communities devoted to salmon, both from as commercial fishing families, Alaskans, Canadians, people of the Pacific Northwest. There's a very vibrant sport fishing community. There's a very strong and active conservation community who understand that salmon are among the most resilient of species on Earth, and that they may be surviving in spite of all the disrespect paid to them, the destruction of their habitat, the degradation of their water quality, the exploitation of them as a commercial resource. There's a strong community out there who fight simply for the fish, who don't care if they catch one or not. So salmon have an awful lot of friends. What's working against them, however, is the lack of political courage often to do the things necessary. We know what the science tells us. The science has been clear for many years what needs to happen. There needs to be some major modifications to river systems, and including taking out several very destructive dams, some that provide very little societal benefit, some that will cost much more to simply maintain than they will ever provide in societal benefits. Some of those really need to be looked at as candidates for removal, and in fact, their removal could do wonders in helping restore these species. There's also a need to reconnect the average citizen, primarily in the western United States, with where their power comes from, how it's derived, and what it does, what damage it does to the environment. There's a general awareness, but industry has been very, very skilled at often portraying salmon as the enemy to cheap power, and we believe that's a false choice, that good businessmen simply won't rely on exploiting and degrading natural resources to provide a cheap product, that we can and must do better. So we have a job to let people know that dams indeed do kill salmon. Dams, though, indeed provide reasonably low-cost power to much of the western United States. But there's a point where we can't simply choose cheap electricity over the continued existence of a species. And that really is one of the things we're going to have to face societally and politically, is does the Endangered Species Act mean anything? Will we allow a species to go extinct for our convenience, or because saving it may inconvenience us a bit? We don't want the latter to happen.
We have heard for years about the complexity of the web of nature, but now nature itself is caught in a complex web of humanity. Will it survive? Stay tuned.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Like so many other things these days, it seems the voice of nature is being heard again. To an ever-increasing degree, many Americans these days are saying, enough. This week, the courts ruled in favor of salmon, creating the hope, finally, that some reason may be brought to bear on the future of this magnificent species. In just a moment, we hear about the current decisions and the future of salmon when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wildside News. With a recent court ruling, the future of the salmon within the Columbia River watershed may find its impediments to its survival disappearing. We conclude our conversation with Charles Hudson of the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. The salmon have been caught in the middle of this political battle. There has been quite a battle going on that has been fought in the courts, and recently there has been a decision by the Ninth Circuit Court that it takes a fairly strong stand to do some of the things that you're talking about, that say there are justifiable reasons to continue this process of restoration, which could include removal of dams and other considerations. There's been some very recent decisions on that. Why don't you bring us up to date on that?
The effort to save the salmon in the Pacific Northwest is no stranger to politics and lawsuits, and we have been in the thick of that, and we remain in the thick of that. There have recently been a series of quite stunning legal victories by the tribes and many parties in the conservation community against the United States government. The United States government, incidentally, has a responsibility to create a salmon restoration plan by virtue of the Endangered Species Act. And my apologies for not mentioning this earlier, but most of the fish, most of the salmon in the Columbia River have been listed as threatened or endangered species since 1991. And the first four listed fish in the Snake River in 1991, and then subsequently nine more different species since then. We're on to 16, 17 years of fish being identified as threatened or endangered. There has never been one day that a federal salmon plan has been legal in the eyes of the United States courts. There have been several plans put forth. All of them have been struck down as inadequate for various reasons, going back to 1995, later in 1999 and 2000, and most recently the 2004 salmon plan was declared illegal in 2005. That decision by Oregon District Court Judge James Redden was just upheld this week by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. In very strong and no uncertain terms did that court uphold James Redden's earlier ruling. The courts are showing increasing frustration and impatience with the United States government to do something effective, to do something meaningful for the salmon in the Columbia Basin. There have been a lot of false attempts. There have been several insincere efforts by both Democratic administrations and Republican administrations alike in crafting a sound and effective salmon plan. The courts are showing signs of being simply fed up with it. You couple these decisions over the last 3 and 4 years that we've won in the Columbia River with some of the decisions that are being won on the Missouri River that are favorable to species there that are also threatened and endangered. And you're creating, we've now created a body of case law that looks quite favorable for species management in the United States, that the courts have simply looked at the scientific evidence and said, U.S. government, you are not doing enough. And that is where we are now, is trying to identify how, by providing good scientific data, by providing plans to the federal government so they can effectively get behind a meaningful and effective salmon recovery plan. This is not to say that we won't go through a few more years of the merry-go-round, but it appears now that the game is up, that we're approaching an end game where somehow the political will have to be mustered to make a good decision in the public interest to make sure that these species not only don't go extinct, but can begin to recover to levels so that they are not endangered or threatened.
Once these legal encumbrances have finally been dealt, well, never finally be dealt with, but once you've achieved some sort of critical mass and you can begin to truly develop the restoration plans that you feel are required, talk to us from your perspective what you expect to see, what you hope to have throughout the watershed.
Salmon management is often categorized in something called four H's, and that is habitat, hatcheries, harvest, and hydropower. We know that salmon harvest has been very well managed for about 30 years through several court cases, through several management realms, both the ocean harvest and the in-river harvest of Columbia Basin species is very well crafted, it's very well regulated, and very strictly enforced. We all know that while there is a little bit of harvest of all species, some for treaty harvest, it is essentially a minimal factor in salmon management now, or has minimal impact by design.
Because there's so few salmon to harvest.
Exactly, yeah, and what salmon there are, the harvest rates are designed to have the most minimal impact. In many cases, there is zero harvest, and in fact, the tribes, their sacred fish, the spring Chinook, there was zero harvest from 1977 till 2001 on that species. What it says is that simply not fishing alone will not recover those fish. We found that out the hard way when many said, oh, tribes and sport fishermen and commercial fishermen, if you simply quit fishing, these fish will recover. Well, in some cases, as I said, the spring Chinook or the summer Chinook, where there was a fishing moratorium for about 40 years, the species simply didn't recover. Mm-hmm. And it was just evidence that the other factors causing their demise and decline needed to be addressed in a vigorous way.
Well, let's go through some of those. I think
I mentioned earlier that the massive habitat destruction. There is work being done with that. There is also very good habitat that remains in the Columbia Basin, particularly in Idaho. There is pristine, beautiful habitat, tributaries with timber and clear water just waiting for fish to repopulate those areas. But the fact is they can't get there. The dams, these four dams on the Snake River, four dams on the Columbia River, are preventing what fish may get up there. The juvenile fish, the baby fish going down, die in the hydro system on their journey out to river. I want to make that distinction very clear, that most of the fish that die in this system are killed as baby fish trying to move down the river. The adults, the few adults that do get up and spawn in the tributaries, a year later, their baby fish, about the size of an index finger, began moving down the river, and they at each dam, a percentage of them are killed. And by the time they pass eight dams, temperature, predators, the turbines have taken a considerable toll on that population.
And just to make it clear, these fish literally have to pass through those systems.
Yes, they do, and that that is one of the things, one of the many things we're working on. One is to make a home for the fish in those tributaries, find a way to get them back up there as adults. The adults that do survive and go out to the ocean and come back are very resilient. They cannot quite successfully navigate the fish ladders and get back up to their tributaries. What we really need to work on is getting those baby fish down the river safely so they can get to the estuary and out to the ocean and have a chance to complete their life cycle. That is the critical phase, is getting from the tributary down through all of the dams and reservoirs behind the dams safely out to free-flowing water.
You mentioned hatcheries. That certainly is a part of this, and that I'm sure is primarily a matter of funding and will. If you create, let's say, lots of fingerlings, can you plant them in these tributaries, and will that restart the process?
That is one way. Yeah, that is one way of doing it, and that is actually one way strongly not only advocated by our tribes, but actually practiced by our tribes. A little history is each dam was conceived, proposed, and then built, there was an acknowledgement that this dam will hurt salmon. It will have an impact of some sort, of some degree, on the fish population. So there was typically a companion funding mechanism to build and maintain a hatchery, which was intended to mitigate for the effect of the hatchery. So and hatcheries, by design, are not unlike maternity wards in hospitals, where historically any populations in the world, mortality was often highest at childbirth and then in the first few weeks and first year of life.
Mm-hmm.
A hospital, and one of the benefits of hospitals was to create a closely monitored and controlled environment that would reduce infant mortality through close monitoring, assistance in childbirth, and then in that very critical first few days and weeks and months of a life cycle. That's not unlike what a hatchery does. A hatchery intervenes in that portion of the life cycle from the egg to the smolt phase, and its intention is to reduce the natural mortality on those fish and to simply result in more smolts being alive at the end of that phase of life. Mm-hmm. So it's an artificial way, indeed, of intervening in the life cycle of a fish, but by increasing the survival to the smolt stage, you can, in theory, mitigate for the effects that dams have on other life stages of the fish. Now, that's kind of the principle that hatcheries operate under. The hatcheries, unfortunately, were used for reasons that were never respectful to the salmon themselves. They were simply used to create fish, often called just meat markets or meat hatcheries, to create a bunch of fish for fishermen to catch to be consumed. In the tribal view, as long as there are dams, we will probably need hatcheries to mitigate for effects of them, but they can be used in a way that's more in keeping with the genetic and physiological integrity of the species. We can preserve some of the genetics of any particular run of fish. We can blend those hatchery fish with some of the naturally spawning fish and try to help preserve and even enhance the population using hatcheries wisely.
Why is genetic mixing to keep a healthy population?
Any species or population has a genetic makeup. Its success is related to its genetic diversity. Its genetic diversity helps it withstand factors affecting it, from temperature to predators to its ability to adapt to landslide into the river and get through, its ability to avoid certain diseases that are, you know, natural diseases to fish, etc. As you start to lose fish, populations become smaller. That whole gene pool or the genetic diversity begins to diminish. Much of the genetic diversity of the fish in the Columbia River is contained in fish that are in hatcheries. We consider the fish in hatcheries to contain very valuable genetic diversity in some cases, in many cases, not all cases, because some fish have been so horribly mismanaged that they are essentially unfit to be used anymore for rebuilding. The tribes look at, in a very holistic way, all of these so-called H's, the hatcheries, the hydro power system, harvest, and habitat. And there are things we can do, indeed, in each of those. We believe most of the attention needs to be paid to the hydro system because that is the single greatest cause of mortality and damage to these populations. Saving fish in the Columbia River is not insurmountable. It actually is achievable, but it's going to take some very well-defined, well-known steps. It's going to cost a bit of money. It won't break the bank, as many people who view salmon as a threat to livelihoods, to farmers, etc. It's not accurate. In fact, many farmers have seen the opportunities in reforming their farming practices to accessing new transportation systems. Many of their crops are barged on the Snake River. They know that with a little bit of adjustment to transportation systems that they can get their crops as effectively to market by rail or by truck as they could by barge, sometimes quicker, sometimes cheaper. So we're looking for ways to help communities that might be affected by salmon improvements to not be adversely impacted. Where once the theory was mitigate for the fish, while we overhaul the river from a natural to an industrialized form, let's mitigate for the fish. Now we're thinking about it in reverse. Let's repair some of the damage and rethink some of these systems and mitigate for the people. Some of the original design, some of the original transformations of the river system have gone obsolete. Some of the original industries conceived simply don't exist anymore, yet we're left with the damage done and the relics, some of the dams that simply have outlived their purpose. So we're looking to identify those places where hydropower reforms need to take place, up to and including removal of some problematic dams. In some cases, it may mean structural modifications to dams to allow water to pass more quickly and effectively through them, and therefore fish. There's an undeniable connection between water, the abundance and free movement of water, and fish survival. That's one fact that just cannot be disputed, is that the more a river functions and acts as a natural flowing river, the better salmon fare in that river. And so we're among the hydro actions is to try to restore our rivers, even with the dams in place, into a system that shows signs of its original integrity of a free-flowing river. We can do that. We can do that. And where we have done that, there has been great success.
We're talking with Charles Hudson, who's the public affairs manager with the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. And the CRITFC, which you can see at www.CRITFC.org, has some fairly well-specified guidelines and goals. As you look out into the future, what's your timeline and hope for revitalization of salmon?
Well, we are trying to rally the states of the Northwest and the federal government in the major, what are called the action agencies, the major river management agencies, around what we call the doubling goal. We've identified it, and that is within 25 years to double the amount of adult fish returning to the Columbia River. Now, that's not a new goal. It's a goal that was established back in the late 80s when roughly 2.5 million fish were coming back into the Columbia River, so doubling that, 5 million fish. And sad to say, since that goal was agreed upon in 1988, the number of fish returning has actually shrunk in half.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got some work to do. Once the goal was established, there began an even farther backslide of the starting point. So we are continuing to press upon our fellow managers, the states and federal agencies, to work with us to achieve that original doubling goal, 4 to 5 million fish. That is roughly one quarter to one third of the original size of the Columbia River run. We think that that's a pragmatic and achievable goal. It's going to take some work. It's going to take some sacrifice, but we can do that.
Then two questions. The first question is, are there concerns that there's been a backsliding? Are there fears that this could continue?
Oh, absolutely. And that has been addressed quite bluntly by the recent court opinions. We have taken our arguments through litigation. It's one of the tools we use to attempt to get responsible actions and activities from federal agencies. The courts have been quite pointed in their criticism of federal salmon plans, that they are not using the data wisely, that they're crafting salmon plans that wouldn't be expected to achieve results, and in fact are even simply attempting to rewrite the Endangered Species Act as to simply absolve themselves of responsibility to do anything, as was the most recent case. That prompted recent pointed rebuke from the Ninth Circuit Court, calling the federal salmon plan, quote, sleight of hand, unquote.
Well, I thought that was a rather unique interpretation, which I'm sure you can define better than I can, the fact that the dams are already in place, and I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
Well, the Bush administration has had one major chance to rewrite the salmon plan, but by virtue of a court decision, they're taking their second chance at it. But in the first opportunity to craft salmon policy, instead of approaching the problems presented by the hydro system that are well known and well documented in scientific literature, they simply sought to say the dams are part of the natural landscape or part of what's called the environmental baseline, which to the tribes was one of the coldest slaps in the face we could have imagined. To simply tell the tribal people with treaty rights to salmon who've sacrificed so greatly for so long in this country that they should expect to simply see a species go extinct because now these massive blockades in their rivers are simply part of the natural landscape, as if they were left there by the receding glaciers.
Well, because they were there when the law was written.
Right. It's preposterous. It was an attempt by the administration, and probably written by some in industry colleagues, that the dams are suddenly sacrosanct. They're untouchable, immovable objects, and simply must be considered part of the landscape as a waterfall or a tree or a rock or a whirlpool. It's ludicrous, and it was seen as such by the courts. Immediately and without ambiguity have the courts said, this is preposterous, this is contrary to the law, the Endangered Species Act law, as put to the country by Congress back in the 70s.
Well, Charles Hudson, I'm sure everybody realizes at this point that this is a very complex and amazing story. I wish you great success at this point, because there has been this little turn in the road here that may lead to a reversal of some of these trends. Why don't you invite people to your website once more so that
Absolutely.
They can find out more about this. And by the way, it's a beautifully done website.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, please visit us at www.CRITFC.org, and that is the acronym for the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission. We are four tribes on the Columbia River, residing in the states of Idaho, Oregon, and Washington, with treaty fishing rights to the Columbia River. We're trying very hard to keep this amazing species viable here. We're reaching out to anybody and everybody we can to help us in this fight. It's going to take a lot. It's going to take a lot of public will. It's going to take a lot of public participation. It always has, but calls to governors, calls to your local political representative, to your senator's office, and let them know that the ongoing tragedy on the Columbia River is one that's needless, that it simply has become so complicated by design. There are those that want to make this seem impossible to achieve, and in so doing, the public will simply lose interest in it. But they're failing. The salmon remain an icon in the Northwest. The salmon continue to have the most devout of following from school children, and that commitment continues to grow every year of people who simply refuse to see fish end up as museum pieces. They want that quality of life that we hear so much about, that all communities are seeking, is clean water. They want their species to be viable. They want their species to not be disappearing. They don't want to have to go to a museum to simply see what used to be in their midst.
Well, Charles Hudson, a lot of people talk about the effectiveness of the oral tradition, and I think this has been a prime example of exactly that. I want to thank you so much for giving us such a beautiful, far-reaching, visionary perspective on this, the state-of-the-art of the salmon in the Columbia River. Charles, thanks so much for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Well, thank you, Sydney. It's been a pleasure. And again, I look forward to working with you again, and the best to all your listeners.
Changing the course of history has always been an upstream battle. But like the salmon itself, all of the struggles are what life itself is made of. We wish the great salmon and all its people a time when peace again will reign between humans and the great spirit that enkindles our will. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until next Thursday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth will call out around the world, here on the Wild Side News.